Okay, count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I believe you can do it. Okay. We're interviewing Jim Lucas in his home in Miles City. Jim served 6 terms in the House of Representatives from the 1962 election to the 1974 election, was Minority Floor Leader and Speaker twice. Jim, what motivated you to get involved in politics? What caused you to become interested in politics?
Well, I think it started back in my university days, and at that time I became interested in politics. First of all, facetiously, my father was a lifelong Democrat, and I always told him about the family of boys, and as soon as they learned to read and write, they became Republicans. And I thought I was going to persuade him, and eventually he did. But in seriousness, I was interested in what was happening in Montana, what was happening nationally, and felt that if you had some convictions and wanted to do something about it, the arena of politics was a place to be.
You felt you could make a difference in being involved in politics more than most other things you could do.
That's correct.
What was there about the Republican Party, that the Republican philosophy, that was appealing to you?
Well, it seemed to me that it was more basic. It believed in the integrity and worth of the individual. It did not subscribe to the idea that government was the solution to all problems. I felt that it just gave a person the ability to grow more and to fit into the scheme of our country, which really was to develop freedom, develop individuality, and to move that along in the best interests of society. And to me, the Republican Party at that time seemed to be more aligned to those possibilities.
Was there any Republican leader that maybe was an inspiration to you? Any Republican figure you can remember that might have?
Oh, I think Dwight Eisenhower was very much in my mind. I attended the National Convention as an alternate delegate. I think it was in 1954 or 56, I forget which it was, and Nixon was being moved into the limelight as the candidate for vice president. But certainly I felt that that President Eisenhower governed with an even hand. He might not have been the most brilliant tactician in politics, but he understood people, he understood where he wanted the country to go. And then, of course, as the years wore on, we saw other people that I felt were great presidents, one of them in the same line and same mode as President Eisenhower, of course, was President Reagan. And I think even President Nixon came in there, brilliant mind, great ideas on the foreign situation, and then got caught into the Watergate debacle, and that was the end of that.
Did you ever meet Governor Aaronson?
Good friend of mine. I, in fact, headed his campaign down in this part of the state and traveled with him around this area.
If someone had never met him before, how would you describe him?
Well, you'd have to listen to him a while, first of all, to understand him with his brogue. And then once you understood him, you began to see that there was quite a bit of depth to the man, which didn't appear right at the outset. Again, he was sort of in that same vein. He knew how to govern. He knew, felt he knew what was best for the people, the state of Montana, and was well accepted, widely accepted.
Do you remember a conversation or experience or anything with him that you might have had?
Oh, we had so many. I remember about the time that he ran for governor, Miles City was developing its golf course, and it was developing it mostly with volunteer labor. And so he said, "I've been a cat skinner all my life. I want to get up on one of those cats." This was during the campaign, of course, and that wasn't too bad a political move. But he got up on the cat, and he got one corner, the blade hung up, and it spun him around. And so we gave him a bad time and said, "Well, you know, we can see now why you're running for governor and not continuing in the dirt moving business." So Hugo took it, of course, the galloping suite, took it in great stride.
Yeah.
He loved that.
I understand, too, I was told that when he was running for governor, either in 52 or 56, he was at Butte, and he went down into the mines and did some things with some of the miners and that sort of thing. And he liked those kinds of construction kind of opportunities, those opportunities to associate with blue-collar people doing blue-collar jobs.
He was right at home.
It was right at home with it. He was comfortable with that sort of thing.
Well, I forget how he made out in Silver Bow County, because it's always been the dream of Republicans that they're going to win Silver Bow County. I remember Tim Babcock, when he was running, and Mike Couture had been, I think, defeated in the primary, and he hooked up and backed Babcock for the Republican governor. And he took him along one night to a big meeting in Butte, and his wife sang "My Wild Irish Rose" in Hungarian, I think. And she brought the house down. That was a great evening for Tim, and he felt so confident he was going to win Silver Bow County. Well, it never happened.
Oh, no.
He went the same way most Republicans
That's
have.
Right. You get more waves and more smiles and fewer votes than any other town in Montana when you're in Butte.
That puts it just right.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, so you, if I remember correctly, you went to college at the University of Montana. And you were you involved in campus politics?
Yes, I was. I was business manager while I was there, elected business manager, and then also took part with the Young Republicans on campus.
And then you were county attorney, I think?
County attorney here in Miles City for 5 terms, 10 years.
And then you ran for the legislature?
Yes.
And of course, county attorney was a paying job and a responsibility that kept you here. The legislature was almost a labor of love, I think, for most people who did attend. It paid almost nothing. In fact, probably intruded into your law practice and that sort of thing. What possessed you to run for the legislature?
Well, again, having been sort of tied to politics since college days, I had a keen interest and was moving along in Republican circles and just felt that I wanted to be in the legislature. I felt there were some things to be done for Montana and that I could be a part of that. And then I had many friends that were involved in the legislature at that time, and Governor Babcock, soon to be governor, was a good friend, and with some prompting and help from those people, I decided to step into deeper water.
Did you know Governor Babcock when he was a legislator here in Miles City?
Yes, I did. Tim came here in, I think, 1950 or 51, here to Miles City, and I returned home to open my law practice at the same time. And we became inseparable friends. We were very, very close through all the years. And I can remember I represented him. He was trying to get some authority for Interstate Commerce Authority for his trucking firm. And we had a big hearing in Fargo, I think it was, either Fargo or Bismarck, before the ICC, and a Montana representative from the railroad commissioners always sat in at those hearings and was one of the people, and Austin Middleton was the one that sat in on that. Well, anyway,
he used to be sheriff here, didn't he?
He was sheriff here in Custer County at one time. And part of our exhibits was introducing a balance sheet, and we hadn't really looked at the balance sheet. We'd had the accountants prepare because last minute kind of a flurry of things, and when I handed him the balance sheet, it showed that his bank account was overdrawn by $54, and here we were in with the giants of the industry. Burlington Northern was there, Northern Tank Line, and so Austin Middleton said, "My mind is made up. Anybody that is overdrawn $54 needs all the help he can get." So we had a great time.
And then I think, wasn't Middleton also the prison warden at one time? Or no, he was the sheriff, and then he was, well, maybe he was prison warden before he was public service commissioner.
I think he was, if I recall correctly, and then public service commissioner for many years.
And his son, it runs in my mind, was the college roommate of Jimmy Carter at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. I think I remember that little bit of trivia.
Well, you might be right, and I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I think I do remember that, too. Mm. So, you ran for the legislature in 1962. Was there an incumbent that you had to run against, or was there an open seat, or how did that work?
I was opposed. I'm not sure that there was an incumbent. That's a few years back, and my recollection isn't as sharp as it might be. I was opposed and won. I think I was opposed both in the primary and general, but I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, it was a contested election, and I was fortunate enough to be elected.
Had you ever been to the legislature when it was in session before?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So you were somewhat familiar with it.
A little bit. I went up, for example, with our Chamber of Commerce Highway Committee to promote some things, and I was always up there on behalf of the junior college, Miles Community College here in Miles City. So I was in and out of the legislature occasionally and appeared before committees, that type of thing.
And your first session was the 1963 session.
That's correct.
And so Frank Hazelbaker was the Speaker of the House. And was Jerry Anderson the majority leader? Or?
You know, I don't recall. I'm not sure if Jerry was in the legislature that year.
He might not have been.
I don't think he was, but I'm not sure.
He was majority leader, I think, when Clyde Hawks was Speaker in 61.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you remember, were there any legislators or any people that stood out in your memory that first session?
Well, there are quite a few legislators that stick out in my mind in that era, whether they in the first session. For example, Jim Murphy.
Yes.
From Kalispell,
yeah.
And your part of the country,
yes.
And Con Lundgren and
yes.
Matt Himsel, three great Flathead County representatives at that time. And then Tom Harrison from Helena, who was the son of the Supreme Court Judge Jim Harrison. Tom, a very effective legislator. And then when you go across the aisle to the to the Democrats, of course, you always remember Francis Bardineau, who was an effective legislator. And there were a number of them that sort of run together in my mind at this time. But some great legislators.
Now, later to be governor, Tom Judge was a legislator then.
Yes.
Was he in the House with you?
He was in the House. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever imagine that he might become governor?
No, in fact, I had no idea that he might move on into the governorship area, but for some reason he was able to do that.
Now, Tim Babcock had served in the legislature, but before you, so you didn't know him as a legislator. I mean, you didn't serve with him as a legislator.
No, I didn't serve with him. He served from Custer County, and then he served from Yellowstone County, and I did not serve during those times that he was there.
Did you know Governor Nutter?
Yes, Don Nutter from Sydney, part of the country.
Even though you didn't actually serve with him.
No, I didn't serve with him, but...
Did you ever visit him with him or
many times, got
to know him a little bit? How would you describe him?
Forceful, effective. He had strong-minded and usually pretty well thought out. Don came back after, I think, serving in the military, and by that time he was, if I remember correctly, a little older person and enrolled in law school.
Yeah.
I think he went into law school maybe when he was about 40, 42. And, you know, he just hung right in there. He was a determined person. He got his law degree, opened his practice in Sydney, and then got into politics and became governor.
Now, you served with... Well, actually, let's see. Tom Tao, I guess, came there later, didn't he?
I'd say maybe I'd been there a couple of sessions at least before he appeared on the scene.
And he was very much a legislative activist. He introduced a lot of bills and that sort of thing, especially pertaining to taxation legislation and so on. Did you ever have dealings with him? Do you remember?
Yeah, I liked Tom. He had a keen mind. His wife helped him, incidentally, in a lot of research. Tom was capable, but he was also a loose cannon. He never knew quite where he was coming from, and sometimes got off into some outrageous comments and outlandish circumstances, but he made an impact.
Now, I think maybe in your second session there, you were the minority leader. Is that right?
Yes, I became minority leader, and then the next session, majority leader.
And the speaker when you were a minority leader was Ray Wierinen from Butte.
That's right.
Did you have a working relationship with him? Did he collaborate with the minority? Or?
Well, yes, I think so. Ray sometimes was my recollection of Ray was he was a congenial person, sort of a tough person. Sometimes maybe he liked to party quite a bit. And he also was started running late sessions because the legislature was running behind. And I told him, I said, Ray, that's a mistake, because if you let the guys out of here for an hour for dinner, they're going to go and have a drink or something. They're tired, and they'll probably do that. And oh no, he said, that's fine. Well, we just had a couple of nightmare sessions, one of which there was the mayor of Great Falls, former mayor of Great Falls, was a legislator, Upstarsic, I think might have been his name.
Yeah.
And he got up and went into some wild tirade, and Ray answered him from the podium as speaker, and gosh, there was a shouting back and forth, and finally in all this bedlam, Ray slammed the gavel down and said, we're adjourned. And then he came to me later, he said, you're right, we're not going to do that again.
But he was trying to get more hours in after dinner, trying to get a few more bills off the board. Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, I know.
That was in the days, Bob, when we always ran over. We never adjourned within the 60 days. And we went through the subterfuge of stopping the clock at midnight the 60th day. And so it always read midnight the 60th day, even if you were there into the 70 days and 75 days, as we sometimes were. And
the journal always showed a tremendously long day on the last day.
That's right. Yes.
Now, you were there, I guess, in the kind of the waning days of the power of the Anaconda Company. Any thoughts or impressions on the Anaconda Company and its influence in the legislature? When you were there?
Well, definitely the heyday of the Anaconda Company had gone by, although they were still somewhat of a force to be reckoned with. And they had some pretty astute lobbyists that represented them. Lloyd Crippen, John Lahr, Bob Corrett, those fellows were all very excellent lobbyists, and they were excellent in a couple of ways. One is, you always knew that they were out there for Anaconda Company, of course, but they knew that if they misrepresented things to a legislator, that their stroke or connection or communication with that legislator was gone. And so sometimes you had difficult things or even some legal research that might be involved, and in those days the legislative council wasn't big enough to give you much help. And so you might get some help from those people. They might give you a position paper.
I see. And do some background research for you.
Do some background research. And and I think that happened, with many of the lobbyists. And we found at times that they were valuable, as long as you remember. They were a lobbyist, and they're trying to promote their position. But we found that they were truthful. They might omit something, but they weren't going to misrepresent something.
Now, Jim, the Montana Power Company probably worked closely with the Anaconda Company, and I say that because it's my recollection that Corrett was a Montana Power Company lobbyist.
Oh, you're right. He was Montana Power Company.
But that I think that, in your mind, you kind of associated the two.
Yeah, in those years, I think the three biggest lobbyists, or maybe four, I should say, were lobby groups, were Anaconda Company, Montana Power Company, the oil and gas lobby, and to some extent Green Stamp for a while was a pretty effective kind of lobbyist. And
the railroads, I think.
And the railroads, that's right. Yeah. Well, in the labor unions, too, an MEA, but they were on a tier below the rest of them, I think.
Do you remember a fellow by the name of Al Wilkinson?
Yes, I do, with the Anaconda group. Yeah, and there was, let's see, I think there was a Kirkpatrick also.
Al Kirkpatrick was with the Anaconda.
Again, those were highly qualified individuals.
Boo McGilvra.
Boo had to be rated as the number one character of the lobbying and legislative groups. Boo was a great guy and an incredible sense of humor and an incredible knowledge of Montana history. He just was, if you wanted to know something fairly factual about your state and the background on it and some of the history, you just spent a few minutes with Boo and he usually gave that to you.
And apparently he was a wonderful storyteller.
Oh yes, yeah. I don't recall any specific stories, but I recall sitting and listening to him on a number of occasions with his stories. And I'll tell you, if anyone knew he was telling a story, pretty soon the crowd grew.
Ty Robinson?
Ty Robinson, very, very effective lobbyist. And he had a brother, Cal, who also, the two men were very effective.
You mentioned the AFL-CIO. Do you remember a fellow named Jim Umber?
Jim Umber, and there was a fellow named Crosswhite.
Joe Crosswhite.
I think they were the two major forces
there
early on.
Jim Murray and Ernie Post also?
Jim Murray.
And then for the Farmers Union?
Well, Farmers Union, my recollection there is Clyde Jarvis. Clyde Jarvis.
Yeah.
He was, Farmers Union was pretty antagonistic to the Republican Party at that time, and they had a program at 8 o'clock, I think it was, in the morning.
Featuring the facts.
Yes, that's right. And usually Clyde spent at least a significant portion of his time lambasting me, and so I could count when I was speaker. I could count on my phone ringing about 8:15. It was my wife saying, "Did you hear what he had to say this morning? What are you going to do about that?" But Farmers Union was pretty prominent. I have to tell you something interesting about when you mentioned the labor people. If you can visualize the house with the Charles Russell painting at the end where the speaker is standing and then the body of the legislature out in front of the speaker. Well, up in the gallery is where the lobbyists sat. And in the upper left-hand corner usually sat the labor representatives, and they were right where the delegation from Silver Bow County, which was all Democrats, down below could watch. And when something would come up, you could usually count on one of those fellows giving a signal as to whether they ought to vote down or vote up. And the Butte guys would look up there, and then the signal would happen. And not every one of them. Some of them were independent thinkers, but it happened often enough that it wasn't coincidence. And so finally one day on a sort of a hotly contested vote, I just before I called for the vote, I said, "Now, fellows," pointing up to the labor representatives up there, I said, "Will you fellows stand up and give your signal to the Butte guys again? They haven't been able to see what you're signaling." And so the rest of the gallery started to clap and laugh. And we had a great time.
One time when I was there, I think it was on third reading, a bill that was supposed to have passed third reading died by a couple of votes, and it was a bill that was important to organized labor. And then consternation broke loose a few seconds later up in the front row where the Butte delegation, the Butte legislators sat. And so you were probably speaker, because I think it might have been in 71. I'm not sure about that exactly. It could have been in 73. Anyway, Con Lundgren went over to see what the deal was. And he said he talked to Jerry Lombardi, and he said, "Jerry, what happened? Those guys were just fit to be tied up there." because they were supposed to have voted for the bill and they weren't paying attention. And Jack Healey, who was the guy that was the kind of the dean of their group and was the guy that was kind of the most conscientious, he was giving them hand signals. And somehow or other, as we were going through those third reading books, he got one bill ahead or one bill behind. And Jerry told Con. Con said, "Jerry Lombardi," he said, "I asked Jerry what happened." And Jerry said, "That damn Healey gave us the wrong signal." Blamed Healey for it.
Sure.
Healey was the only one that was paying attention.
They were quite a crew.
Yeah, they were quite
a crew. I always had a great deal of good feeling towards the Butte fellows. We seemed to hit it off pretty well. And, of course, when I married a Butte girl, that didn't hurt things either. But there were times when I knew I had to have some votes, and I could talk with those fellows, and I could get them. And there were times when they needed some support. And politics is, whether you like it or not, it does involve some horse trading. I found them sensible. Now, when it came time to consider the community college legislation that made community colleges a separate entity in Montana law, prior to that time, they were just an arm of the high school boards. We were able to get great support from the Butte delegation for the community college legislation, and I always sort of appreciated that connection we seem to have.
Well, you probably gave some votes to Montana Tech.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it.
Do you remember the watering holes?
You know something? I not only remember them, but I have a very strong feeling about the watering holes. I felt that the press did a disservice when it started and built the crescendo of the idea that the legislators were hanging out at the lobbying rooms and the water holes, as they called them, and eating their food, and they were hand in glove with them. I saw it from a different aspect. Some of that may have been true, but I saw it from a different way. And that is that after a tough day, it was a time in which you could talk with fellows from across the aisle, people who opposed your legislation. You could discuss and communicate. You could resolve some problems, and that happened many, many times. When they closed that avenue down, they were doing a disservice, because the overall impact, I think, was that it served an area where legislators could let their hair down and talk about things and express themselves, mm-hmm. and there was great give and take in that process.
And I think now, you know, as I think about it, in the modern legislature, there aren't very many places where legislators can just sit down and visit. I mean, there are probably a few taverns and so on in Helena where that might happen, but where legislators could exclusively just sit down and talk over what had happened during the day, and maybe that is something that we kind of miss. I don't know.
Yeah, I think if it's abused, it's no good. And there were times, perhaps, when it was abused. There were times, maybe, when legislators just made it their nightly routine with nothing in mind but to eat what little food was put out and have a few drinks. But my experience with it was that it was a means of exchanging ideas and information and even convincing people.
Yeah. And now you mentioned, Jim, that when you were there, at least the early part of the time that you were there, of course the Anaconda Company had a hospitality room, and then you mentioned that the big forces were, we talked about the gas and oil lobby and the railroads, and you also mentioned trading stamps?
Yes.
What was the issue?
Well, I think the issue was... if people don't recall, that was in the days when you went into a place and bought something and you got 8 trading stamps, depending on how much you bought. And you had
typically
bought.
Grocery stores.
That's right. Mostly grocery stores, but other places too. And then you filled a booklet, and the booklet was worth so much, and you could come in and trade that in. It was a means of of accumulating credit, I guess you'd
so if you did $100 worth of business at the grocery store, and you got how many stamps you get for $100, then when you came in with your groceries the next time, and you turned in your book of stamps, you'd get credit for $2 or $5 or whatever that book was worth on your next sack of groceries,
that's
or something
exactly
like that.
Right.
In it, yeah.
And the big fight was that the green state trading stamps, and there were others than just the green trading stamps, but they were the most prominent, ought to be taxed. And so there was a big fight every year over that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there was great support by Montanans not to tax them. They liked the green stamp thing, and they, at least the input we had. And then, so after about three times of these terrific fights and beating that down, it was pretty obvious that green stamps were not going to be taxed in Montana. But I always accused my friend Jerry Anderson, who was a lobbyist for green stamp trading, that he'd always get somebody to put the bill in to tax green stamps so he could keep his lobbying going.
Well, he was a good one, I'll tell
you.
He was really a good one. Yeah. Now, later on in your legislative career, I think it was 1967, when you were the majority leader, after you'd been the minority leader, when Warenin was the Speaker of the House, the Republicans got the majority back in 1967, and a fellow named Jim Felt became the Speaker, and you were the majority floor leader. And that was the first session when, at least in modern times, when the sales tax was a big issue.
Yes, Jim Felt was a strong supporter of the sales tax, as were many of us. And Jim was also an attorney, but he also had some great training. He might have been a CPA also. He certainly was an astute person in taxation, and very knowledgeable. And so the sales tax surfaced at that time.
Now, Jim, I think it was Jim Hoy who told me that, perhaps in the 63 session, some kind of a special committee, I think he may have told me that all the lawyers in the House of Representatives, or at least on the Republican side, maybe all the lawyers, were members of this committee, and the purpose of the committee, and I might have the session wrong, I think it was a 63 session, carefully went over the tax laws in Montana. And a fair number of the bills were passed over to the Senate, where they were all summarily killed. And if I've got my recollection is right, he felt that that was kind of the beginning of interest in what became the sales tax. Do you remember anything about that?
I remember the committee and
Hoy was the chairman of it, and there was a package of bills, something like 11 bills.
Yeah.
He said, gosh, we worked all session long, and he said we got this package that we put a lot of thought and a lot of effort into, and it got over to the Senate, and Senator Melcher, then John Melcher, was probably the chairman of the Taxation Committee, and he just killed them, the whole bunch of them, just without even much of a hearing, and it was a big disappointment to Hoy. And I asked him why, and he said that was probably the beginning of what ended up being the sales tax fight.
Well, and as I recall,
would Felt have been there then in 63?
Yes, I'm sure he was.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
And part of the discussion that became pretty much a cliched expression as time went on, and the sales tax came more and more into the picture, but part of the comment was the necessity of the tripod of taxation.
Yeah, the three-legged milk.
The three-legged stool, that's right, income tax, property tax, and sales tax.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the beginning of a discussion involving that.
And so a bill was introduced in 1967 with the support of Governor Babcock?
Yes, yes, because you remember that later became an issue in the governor's campaign.
Yeah.
Pay more, what for?
Yeah, in the 1968 campaign for governor. Now, as I understand it, we know most states have a sales tax. Montana's one of three or four that doesn't. And as I understand it, most of the state sales taxes were enacted back in the 1930s in the Depression era, most of them by Democratic legislatures, in order to raise more revenue for government. Generally, Democrats are the party that believes in government. They're more the party of the public sector, and the Republican Party is more the party of the private sector. And so it was a little bit unusual for the Republican Party in Montana to take a leadership role in a new tax, and especially, or maybe not especially, but a new tax and the sales tax. Any thoughts about that?
Well,
what was philosophically, why were we for that in 1967?
Well, for a variety of reasons. First, there was a feeling that property taxation was too high, and so part of the revenues that came from any sales tax bill would have had to have blended into it some property tax relief, and that was important. Secondly, there was a feeling that because our income taxes and property taxes were quite high in connection with the rest of the country, and we weren't able to create enough revenue to do the things that were needed to be done for the state of Montana, that we had to re-examine our tax situation, and that we had to enjoy the benefits that every other state practically was having, and that is the benefit of tourists and tourism contributing a substantial part to your state revenue coffers. My recollection, and of course part of this depends on the design of the particular sales tax bill, but one of the bills we were considering, my recollection is that we estimated that about 22% of the revenue that was produced by that sales tax would be paid for by tourists coming into the state of Montana. I think that's a little higher, this estimate, than some of the later ones, but the sales tax bill each time is a little different creature.
Sure.
And so that was an important kind of consideration. And so first, relief of property tax, secondly, providing more revenue, and third, letting out-of-state tourists contribute towards the expense of our state.
And you'd think that a Democrat legislator wouldn't object to the first and the third of those reasons. He would probably want to have more money to spend on government services, and he probably wouldn't care if we tax the tourists. So the Democrats' philosophical problem came in the area of not wanting to reduce property taxes?
You know, I'll never understand where the... I think it became involved in too much of a political issue where if the sales tax were passed, it would have been credited to the Republicans. It would have been a Republican coup. And the politics of the moment was, we can't let that happen.
Yeah.
I'm talking from the Democrat side, because it is true, back in the earlier years, in the 30s and maybe even the 40s, it usually was a coalition of labor and education,
yeah,
that got sales taxes enacted. Montana was, here was education clamoring for more money, but generally at that point, the MEA and teachers generally were opposed to the sales tax. Labor was opposed to the sales tax. Farmers Union was opposed to the sales tax. And driving a good part of that was the political consideration, we can't let the Republicans get a sales tax and then start to do all these things that we think might be done and claim credit for.
Mm-hmm.
That was a significant part of...
They used the so-called regressivity argument, too.
Yes. Yeah, we felt there probably was some regressivity in the sales tax, but at the same time, when you offer some property tax relief, and currently, of course, there's the talk about tax credits, if
yeah,
anything went that way, you're taking away the sting of regressivity. But you cannot achieve a perfect tax
yeah
structure. It's always yeah going to have some area of criticism and fault.
Yeah.
But the creation of the general picture, bringing the sales tax into it, I think would have been the best thing Montana could have done.
Now, just to explain this regressivity business, because I remember my first experience with the sales tax was 1971. And then, as I recall, that proposal didn't tax medicine and it didn't tax groceries. think I remember that.
I think that's right. It was patterned after the Minnesota tax to some extent.
So right there, the idea would be to try to relieve the burden on people who had a small income and had to spend most of it on necessities. They wouldn't have to spend they wouldn't have to spend anything on any the tax wouldn't apply to medicine or groceries. So that protected them in that regard. But I think the argument also that the people in opposition to it used is they said, but the general public is all going to be paying this sales tax, regardless of their ability to pay taxes, in spite of the fact that you've exempted medicine and groceries, but you're going to provide property tax relief, and the more property you own, the greater the property tax relief you have. So they would argue this is the opposite of Robin Hood. This is taking from the poor and giving to the rich, and that's, I think, how they built that case for regressivity.
Yeah. That and they would take a typical example, and that is that why should a low income earner that's buying a car pay a 3% sales tax, where somebody else with a much more affluent buying a car pay only a 3% sales tax? Our structure of taxation through the years was built around the principle of progressivity. More you earn, not only the more you pay, but that you pay at a higher rate.
Sure.
And so the argument there was that wasn't...
But the response could still be made, the more you buy, the more you pay.
Sure.
So if you can afford to pay a new Cadillac, you're going to pay 3% of that. If all you can afford to buy is a used Chrysler...
Sure. And if a person enjoys a high income, they're going to buy more goods and commodities, not just higher priced ones, but more goods and commodities, and pay a greater amount.
And we still had the property tax. We weren't eliminating the property tax or the sales tax. We still had the income tax.
That's right.
So the high income earner is still going to pay a higher income tax than the low income earner. In addition, he's going to pay sales tax on all the things he buys. So.
Well, it was, you know...
But somehow or other, they just managed to win massively on this thing. They
the effective campaigning, of course, to start with, most of the time, if you're campaigning against a tax, that's the favored position.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can enter all these other arguments into the picture, and it just never, in the two elections we had, if I recall correctly, the vote was about the same, 3-1 against it.
Yeah.
And you start out with the feeling that, well, it's about a 50-50 kind of a deal.
Yeah.
But the devil was in the details.
Every
and
time.
As soon as you start to design it, then you've got this group running off and they're mad because they're not going to get exemptions. And pretty soon,
it collapses.
It is. It's too bad.
I think, too, that the Republicans generally opposed to taxes, generally opposed to government spending. A lot of people who regarded themselves as Republican loyalists and conservatives and voted for Republicans for the legislature, a lot of them had to have voted against the sales tax because the margin of defeat was so great. And I think it probably just gets back to the idea that in spite of the fact that it's based on a defensible theory of taxation, your typical Republican is probably not going to vote for a new tax.
you'd have to think that because of the overwhelming vote against it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We missed the boat. And we've missed it more than once. And we're continuing to miss it.
because that continues to be an issue. But
yes.
And as you say, if you poll the general public in Montana, the polls will show it's close. But then as you actually craft a sales tax, you don't seem to take on new allies. It seems as though you just more and more people fall off the buckboard until finally there's a small minority left that still supports it.
Well, and it always seemed that the campaigning against it, the design of advertising, was always more creative and more compelling when they were against it. And the first and greatest example of that, of course, was Forrest Anderson walking into the room, pointing to the refrigerator, pay more, what for?
Yeah.
And that took off and became a byword. And we never seemed to quite be able to get the positive and sensible slant across to the public.
Now, Jim, I know there were many of us on the Republican side that thought that you at one time maybe had thoughts about running for governor, and there were a lot of us that were enthusiastic about the possibility of supporting you. What effect do you think your association with the sales tax may have had on that?
Well, up until the time the sales tax was rejected at the polls so heavily, I'd started to organize campaign committees around the state and had in mind running for governor. But part of my campaigning and part of my identification in the legislature, of course, was the sales tax issue. And when that was knocked down as dramatically and forcefully as it was, I felt that with it went my hopes, realistic hopes for the governorship. And so I, at that point, I backed off and did not file.
And so, and that was, I think, your last, you didn't run for re-election when, in 1974?
That's right. In 73, I served in the only annual session that they had, and at that point, I decided not to run for governorship. It was becoming increasingly difficult for me to spend the time I was having to spend in the legislature, having been in the leadership positions and so on, and I felt my law practice was suffering, and that was going to be my main thrust in life at that point. And so I, anticipating that annual sessions were going to stay, and I misjudged that one, I did not file again, and of course annual sessions then were voted out the next time.
So you didn't run for the legislature again in 74.
Right.
And you didn't run for governor in 76.
Or in 72.
Oh, you were kind of looking at it in 72,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure, okay. Because the sales tax went down in a special election, didn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. It wasn't on the ballot in the regular election in 72. It was a special election. I see. Okay, I see. And so did you ever consider maybe getting back into politics again later, letting a few years of grass grow on that thing, and maybe getting back into the political arena again?
Yes, I thought about it more than once. But, you know, by that time your life takes some different turns. I still had a young family then, and politics, as you know, Bob, can rob you of your every moment and your energy. And I felt that, I talked it over with my family, and we just came to the conclusion that we would go that direction instead of back into politics. I've stayed in the perimeter through the years, but not in the center of things.
So I suppose this question kind of goes without saying, but I wondered if it occurred to you maybe to run for some public office that would take you back to Washington, D.C., such as congressman or senator, you know, in a different area in state politics or different area in politics.
The year that that Conrad Burns first filed for the Senate, before he filed, I had given serious thought to that.
And running for the United States Senate in 1988.
That's right.
Yeah.
And had a call from the distinguished Wyoming senator asking me,
Alan Simpson,
if I should be interested in, would I be considering running for that office. And I declined, and wasn't long before Conrad's name surfaced, and he was pretty agreeable to that, pretty eager to go, and fortunately generated some good support and was elected.
But you did consider running.
I did consider it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's addictive, and it's a. But like you say, it can consume your whole life. One of my friends described politics. He said politics is a jealous mistress.
That's absolutely true. It is. You've got to be at it
just
day
about
and
all the time.
Yeah,
and it can be tough on your law practice and on your personal life and your family life and that sort of thing. It has been in the case of a lot of people I know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your involvement in politics, you became acquainted. We've already discussed. You became acquainted with Governor Babcock. You knew Governor Nutter, both Republicans, and then you served in the legislature with Governor Judge, And then also, you continued to be a legislator after Judge was governor. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah, sir. Judge was governor in 72.
And
so you, for 2 years, were... Any impressions of... let me ask you first, any impressions of Governor Anderson? You were Speaker of the House when he was governor.
Yeah. Well, he... Governor Anderson was a tough governor. Criticism and problems ran off his shoulders like water off a duck's back. He just hung in there, and he seemed to have a cadre of equally dedicated people. We disagreed on quite a few things, but he had captured the imagination of the people, and at least on the surface of things seemed to present to them a governor who was there and who was busy and who was aggressive and who had ideas for the state of Montana. And so those were some tough times. There were a couple of things that I tried to visit with him on, and of course one of them was the sales tax, but we could never bring him around to our point, even in terms of trying to do some horse trading on legislation he might have been interested in. But so that was my experience with Governor Anderson.
And when he was governor, of course, executive reorganization passed.
Yes.
There had been, I think he reduced the number
of... 20 departments.
Yeah, 20 is plenty was the slogan, and I don't remember how many there had been, but considerably more than that. Do you have any recollections on that? That was a big issue in the state and in the legislature, as I remember.
Yeah, not really. He, that was a hard thing not to, a hard thing to oppose, because it made sense of trying to bring together and make government more cohesive.
Yeah.
And so he was moving in a pretty good kind of a circle on that, and had strong support.
Governor Babcock, you know, you served with him as a legislator. Did you have a working relationship with him then when he was governor? I'm sure you did.
Yeah, extremely close working relationship. As I mentioned, we had been great friends. I'd been his attorney for some time, and we were very close. And I was on his sort of council, if you want to call it that.
Did you have regular meetings with him? Like, did you meet down in the conference room? Republican legislative leaders would go down there and meet with him, or how did
was yeah, it? We had regular meetings with him. Probably, I want to say 6 to 8 people, and he might indicate what his thoughts were and maybe what his desires were, and we would take some of that back to the caucus and present it and do that. He also had another little group of advisors, which I thought was great. He had himself and Lowell Purdy, who I think was Department of Agriculture at that time, and Sonny Omholt, who was State Auditor, Insurance Commissioner, Dick Kimball, who was with the National Guard, myself, seemed there were a couple of others.
Jack Halliwell,
who was his sort of right-hand man in his office.
Yeah, Chief of Staff.
And one of those fellows had either owned or had access to a little cabin out in the valley. And we would meet maybe once a week or once every 10 days or once every 2 weeks. And we might be there for 5 hours just kicking things around, having a great time, very congenial. The thing that the impression I carry from those meetings is, to me, an interesting one. I think most people who get into politics and who become governors and things like that really do have the best interests of their state at heart. They may ride a different horse to get there, but at least I give them that much credit. Some of them maybe have other problems that get in the way. But I felt that Tim Babcock was dedicated to what's best for Montana. Dick Kendall, outstanding person who was head of the National Guard. Sonny Omholt. These were people who really loved Montana. And their time was spent not saying, well, how can we how can we put this over on the Democrats, or how can we do this? It was spent mostly on what can we do that's best for the state, and what are the things best for the state, and how can we get them done? And those were great times, because there was just a commonality of great feeling about our state of Montana, and it was uplifting and inspiring.
Would you consider that group that kind of Governor Babcock's kitchen cabinet? Is that kind of what it would be?
Yeah, I think you could, certainly you could call them that to a great extent.
Were there any private sector people involved at all?
Not that I recall in those things, but there were other meetings and other times when people from the private sector were called in, and people who of their own asked to come in and see the governor, who had great thoughts, good suggestions, things like that. Yeah, he drew pretty heavily from the private sector, because people felt he was an accessible governor, and they at least could be heard.
And I think he was a believer in the free enterprise system. You mentioned this idealism that he had about Montana, and I think that manifested itself too in terms of his philosophy about trying to keep the regulatory burden as minimal as possible and the tax burden as minimal as possible, so that our state economy can move ahead.
That's right.
I think that was his general philosophy. That's how I remember mm-hmm. it too. You were only there in the legislature for a couple of years when Judge was governor.
That's right.
Any impressions at all?
I wouldn't call him a strong leader. He did have some separate ideas and did have some people who had his ear and whom he listened to. My recollection of the state in the couple of years that I was there was that we got along reasonably well, and there was communication.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as he wasn't as powerful and dogmatic as Forrest Anderson had been.
Yeah. You used the term forceful to describe Governor Nutter. And you've used, I'm not sure the same term, but similar terms to describe Governor Anderson. So I take it they both had maybe similar personalities in the respect that they were sort of take charge kind of guys?
Yeah, I think that's true. Governor Anderson was devious. Nutter was more straightforward, but they were people who knew what they wanted to get done, where they wanted to go, and they... most of them believed that the shortest distance was the straight line between two points, and that's where they went.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you say Aronson might have been maybe more like Babcock, maybe a little more
Politic and things?
Yeah, a little more charming and a little less forceful.
I would say so. Hugo Aronson could get his dander up when he wanted to and needed to, but generally I think that's right. He worked with people in his own way, handled people.
Tim Babcock told me one time that there was a bill that got away from him in the legislature that he thought was a bad bill, and he was really concerned about it. It passed the House of Representatives, and he didn't expect it would. And it got over to the Senate, and they thought they might stop it, he and the people who agreed with him, and they couldn't. And he went down to visit with Governor Aronson, and he said, "I'm just sick about this. I think it's a bad piece of legislation." And he explained to the governor why, and he said, "I think it's going to get through the legislature." And he said, Governor Aronson said, "Well, Tim," he said, "there's something we can do about that. We can veto it."
We can weep to it. I can just hear that.
And I guess he did too. I guess he did get it, and I guess he weetoed it. So. Now, did you serve with Stan Stevens? He was in the Senate when you were in the House.
Yes. Yeah. Stan was there.
Did you get to know him at all?
Oh yeah, quite well. Enjoyed Stan. We were good friends. As you probably remember, Bob, the liaison between the House and Senate Republicans and Republicans or Democrats and Democrats is not quite the to the extent that you think it ought to be or it was. And in fact, sometimes, you know, goes back to the old joke I remember about, I think it was President Coolidge or somebody, that the servant came running in to him and said, Mr. President, there's a thief in the house. And he said, in the Senate, perhaps, but never in the House. And sometimes there seem to be the proprietary feelings between the House and Senate where you didn't work hand in glove quite like people think you probably should have.
Oh, I know.
Plus the fact that time, gosh, you're just snowed under all the time, yeah. Trying to read bills and get ready and be on top of them, and you just don't get the communication going like you should. And it's too bad, but despite that, we always enjoyed an excellent rapport with Stan Stevens, and as far as that goes, I think most of the people who were in the Senate.
This is probably politically incorrect in this day and age to say this, but one day I remember I was in the, tried to move from the House over into the Senate. I was at my desk, and my old good dear friend Matt Himsel had gone over to the House to talk to somebody about something, and he came back over to the Senate and said, geez, I was just over to the House of Representatives. That damn place is like an Indian camp. Because there was a lot of activity and a lot of people
sure.
talking to each other,
yeah,
not paying attention, you know.
Well, the Senate has always been a little more composed, maybe a little more sedate. And, of course, we used to say, now, if you're going to go over to the Senate, over there and walk with a cane so you feel right at home.
Yeah.
A lot of good natured joking.
A lot of rivalry, that sort of thing. Well, I remember, must have been about 1979 or maybe even 81. The Senate House, they must have had the basketball games, didn't they, when you were there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And the House always won the basketball games, mm-hmm. because the House were twice as many members of the House of Representatives, and generally the younger people were in the House.
That's right.
Well, somehow or other, whenever this was, it might have been in the early 80s, the Senate had Tom Beck and Billy Yellowtail at the same time. And they were both, in their 40s, but they were big, tall men in reasonably good physical condition who had been outstanding basketball players when they were young. And Joe Mazurek might have been on the team at that time also.
Mm.
And he was quite a good basketball player. Anyway, in an incredible upset, the Senate won the Senate House basketball game. And that kind of changed the dynamics of that whole legislative session. You know, the senators were all walking with a little bit of a spring in their step, you know. Made them all feel about 10 years
sure.
younger, I think.
That's great. Those were good times.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Do you remember the mock sessions?
Yes, sure do.
And now, I wasn't there when they were going on, but we've mentioned Jerome Anderson, Jerry Anderson. And I think he was kind of the director. The designer of those. Mm-hmm. What are your recollections of them? Maybe describe those a little bit.
Well, they were great because You didn't want to be at a mock session if you were thin-skinned, because they would take off on you, and if you'd had a bad day or a bad moment, somebody remembered it and they'd embellish it from there. But they were a mock of the legislature in session, and the speaker would call on someone and they'd take off on that, and it was just a lot of good-natured ribbing back and forth.
So Jerry Anderson, Jerome Anderson, who had been a legislator, and then by then was a lobbyist.
That's right.
Would kind of keep notes, kind of keep a recollection throughout the session of interesting things, funny things, embarrassing things, and so on that happened during the legislature. And then he'd get the legislative staff?
Yes.
He'd get the clerks and the secretaries and those kinds of people, and they would maybe dress up as different legislators. Did they do this in the House chamber?
In the House chamber, because that was the larger area for that.
And so the legislators themselves, I suppose, would sit up in the gallery or around the sides on the floor and that sort of thing? And
well, they sat in their seats, many of them, and around the sides. And, of course, there was a big crowd. Many of the wives or spouses were there.
Yeah.
And some of the legislators themselves would participate, because there were some that were musically talented, and they had a song or two that they would have along the way. In fact, if I remember correctly, Jerry might even have written a song or two, or at least composed verses to a song.
I wonder if any of those were filmed. I wonder if there's any record of any of those.
I doubt it, and I doubt it for this reason today, if that happened, and it does happen. Today they would be filmed, because it's, you know, it's just a matter of course. Everybody's got a VCR and a camera,
camcorder,
digital and everything. And those days you didn't have that. You had the old motion picture machines. Most time they didn't work. And I don't know of any that were filmed, but Jerry would be the guy who would know.
They
were great. I think the two great fun events of the year were the mock session and then the attaché party, which was early in the year when all of the attachés and clerks and staff for the legislature and all the legislators would have this big evening party and dinner and dance, and it was just a great time. And that happened usually before the session was too old, and it was a means of trying to get everybody sort of acquainted with everybody. It worked very well.
And was Jerry Anderson, was he an organizer of that too?
No. No, he wasn't. In fact, I think one year Walter Marshall, who acted as clerk of the House for a time, was the organizer of that.
Of the attaché party.
Of the attaché party. Yeah. And I'm not sure who else really took the lead on those attaché parties.
Now, Walter Marshall, I think he was Secretary of the Senate for a while when I was there. And didn't he own the voting machine? The voting equipment in the Senate and the House?
Yeah, I think he did.
He purchased them and leased them to the legislature or something?
Leased to the House, and he had more side businesses going than you can shake a stick at, and that was particularly during the years when the party he was affiliated with was in power there, and so Walter could do no wrong. He was sort of the runner and the chief arranger. And
he was a real character. One time, I remember, he wrote a book called I Met Them All, which wasn't a real great book, frankly, and this might have been in the book, but I don't think it was. I think he told me this. John F. Kennedy, while he was a senator from Massachusetts but considering running for governor, came to Montana in 1958 or 1959, and I believe he spoke the Democratic State Convention, and Walter got to pick him up at the airport. I don't know if it was just Walter or not, but anyway, Walter was in the car, and somehow or other, it was Walter's car, and Walter had his dog in the back of the car, according to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, the dog managed to reach up and lick the back of Kennedy's neck. And, you know, Kennedy was a little unused to that kind of treatment, and Walter had to apologize about his dog. And then, according to Walter, a couple of years later, after Kennedy was president, he came to Montana and he went to Great Falls, and he visited Senator Mansfield's parents in Great Falls. They went to their house. And Walter, of course, was there and on hand and that sort of thing, and got right up in front and shook hands with Kennedy and you know, reminded him that he picked him up at the airport. And he said, Kennedy said to him, "You still got that damn dog?"
Well, Walter could weasel his way into any situation easier and quicker than anybody I ever knew. He was incredible.
Yeah, he was incredible. Well, Jim, any other thoughts or observations or anything you'd like to say?
No, I think Montana still has great problems. We have great problems in this end of the state in the development of our natural resources. As you're aware, the Powder River Coal Basin extends from Wyoming north into Montana into the Ashland Broadus area, and that's some of the finest coal in the world. And Wyoming has reaped the benefit of mining that coal, doing good reclamation, don't hear any complaints about that. I think the days of suggesting that you don't reclaim coal mining areas are probably pretty well gone, because industry knows and business knows they've got to reclaim it, and there are ways to do it, and they've done it. But we can't seem to get off dead center in developing that great asset. And if it's something that needs to be done, should have been done, it's there waiting to be utilized, and you've got the consortium under the name generally of Tongue River Railroad, people and the financial backers that are ready to move on it. But there is always something in the way. There's an environmental group here and a group there, and they're into court and they're managing to stop and stall those things, and we just keep looking for it to come. It can be done, I think, in a way in which the earth is protected, in which the environment is protected, in which there's not going to be undue damage to ranchers across whom the railroad must cross. It's got to come, and if it does, it'll be an enormous thing for southeastern Montana. So we have, here's Custer County, one of the poorest counties in the state. That railroad would come here and, of course, hook up with Burlington Northern. And there's talk, of course, of some power generating plants that also would be created. Be a great thing for the state of Montana and for this area. It's frustrating that that we can't seem to move those kind of enormous things forward at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sit here and watch and wonder and feel that the legislature can't seem to seize the moment in an effective way.
Sometimes I think events force decisions to be made. Right now our country is embroiled in what looks like an unending conflict in the Middle East, and we're heavily dependent on that part of the world for our energy, and it may be that we'll decide to become more serious about becoming energy independent. And if we do, that could mean that Montana coal and other domestic sources of energy are going to have to be developed. Maybe that'll happen sooner than later.
Yeah, you may well be right, and I think the seriousness of our dependence upon oil in that part of the world, and the fact that the spigot can be turned on and off, has brought more of a realization, and maybe that will be the underlying impetus that moves these things forward. I hope so, because I think it's the right thing to do.
We're just about out of tape, and this would probably be a good place to end our interview, but a couple more things have just jumped into my mind. Did you ever meet Mike Mansfield?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, had great admiration for Mike Mansfield. Very solid kind of a person, deep thinking person.
Did you meet him back in Washington, D.C., to visit with him back there?
A number of times. My first real contact with Mike Mansfield was back in the 40s. And at that time, I was on the university debating team, and we were fortunate enough to win a number of debates, and were preparing to debate in West Point in the national finals. And one of the issues was something to the effect that resolved that the Chinese rising is a solid kind of movement and not backed or sponsored by the Communist Party. In other words, China was in a stage of unrest, and I think Mao Zedong at that time was coming to the forward. So I got in. Mike Mansfield was considered as an expert in that area, and I got in touch with him and asked him for some papers and some facts and some figures, which he sent me.
Yeah.
And he had to be prepared to debate both sides of the question.
Sure.
And so that was very helpful to me. I used a lot of the materials that he sent.
Yeah.
And we did extremely well when we were back there, and I, in part due to the resource material we had. So from that time on, there I had intermittent contacts with Mike Mansfield, and when I was back in Washington, stop at his office sometimes, and always managed to get an audience with him if he was there, and appreciated our contacts through the years.
You probably knew Congressman Batten, too.
Yeah, Jim Batten was a close friend of mine, and I worked on his campaigns as a congressman.
Did you know him as a lawyer, too?
Knew him as a lawyer and knew him later as a judge, and he became an exceptionally good judge. When he was appointed judge, I'd known him more, I guess, in the political end of things, and I wasn't certain about that appointment. But it turned out to be an excellent one because Jim Batten became a very, very good federal judge.
Yeah, and then died kind of young, I think.
Yeah.
Was it cancer?
I think that's right. I don't recall for sure.
When you were a county attorney, Arnold Olson was attorney general.
Yes. Arnold Olson was attorney general, but later on, I think Forrest Anderson was attorney
general. That's
right,
Yeah. And then did you ever cross paths with Senator Metcalf?
Just occasionally. I couldn't say I was a close acquaintance of his at all.
You knew Melcher, of course, because
yes.
You served in the legislature with him.
Yes, sure did.
Any thoughts or impressions at all?
Well, sort of an embarrassing moment. He was out of the legislature, and then he came back and ran and was elected to the House. And he, in my mind, was a freshman. And he
had been in the state Senate.
That's right.
Then he came back in the House.
Yes, but he had an interlude between the Senate and the House. And he wanted to be on, as I remember, taxation committee, finance and claims. I was determined that he wasn't going to sit on that committee, and I didn't put him on it. And I put him on a couple of other committees, and so he actually stood on the floor of the House and made a motion that he be added to that committee. And this was when I was speaker and appointing the committees. The speaker appoints the committees. And I said, well, I'm not going to rule your motion out of order, Representative Melcher, but I want to remind you that you have another committee or two that I've appointed you on, and I guess it's within the province of the speaker to disappoint anybody who might have been on a committee, and you may not be serving on those committees. And so there was a lot of fuss, and finally the minority leader, whoever it was for the Democrat Party, said, well, Mr. Speaker, I think probably it's right, that is out of order. Well, he didn't get on that committee, and later on, when he became a United States Senator, I thought, geez, Jim, you goofed up. you insulted your future United States Senator.
Pat Williams, you served in the House with him.
Yes.
He was there, I think, what, in 65 and 67, or 67 and 69?
Something like that, yeah.
Any recollections of him?
No. Don't have really any recollections of Pat. I knew Pat, knew him fairly well, and his wife was a classmate of my wife's in Butte during those years, but never really knew Pat real well.
Then, of course, he served briefly as a congressman for the whole state.
That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The last couple of years he was in Congress, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, you probably knew Congressman Marlaney.
Yes, in fact, my daughter worked for him for I think 6 years or so back in D.C.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew Ron quite well. I knew him before, and then knew him as years went on.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, I don't think so. Okay. Been very interesting. It conjures up a lot of recollections.
Well, we sure appreciate the interview, Jim. Thank you so much.